encouraged, not burdened by the history that they create. They know what is expected of them. They are Manchester United.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Fergie Fledglings. I'm your host, Colin Dams. Polly Questel with me today. No Nathan. Recording the day after a pretty disappointing Manchester Derby result. Polly, did you go into this with the kind of, if you have low expectations, then you can't be disappointed?
Oh, 100%.
Approach. Yeah.
Are you 100%? But you know what? I was
still disappointed. Yeah.
I was not disappointed about the outcome because we lost. I expected that. I was disappointed about how like it felt like the longest 90 minutes I've watched all season in a season where many of the 90 minutes have been atrocious. This one just felt so long and so helpless.
I thought you had more, but yeah.
I have more. I was letting you get some more words in.
I woke up fully expecting to lose. I was a little surprised the way that it sort of played out the way United normally have gone this season, which is...
You mean that they weren't down immediately?
Yeah, it was like... The first 25 minutes or so, you know... maybe there's a path forward in a couple of these cases, but I should have taken the vibes check from, what was it, the seventh or eighth minute that Haaland had that chance right in front of goal, Johnny Evans was marking both him and I think Julian Alvarez, who had the first chance. And during this whole, like, the first chance goes in, Onana makes the save, he's on the ground, Haaland has his foot up, you know, at Onana's head height, basically, because he's on the ground and Haaland is huge. Looks like it's going to be a certain goal. Somehow gets another hand up. And Harry Maguire, thankfully, is the one center back who realizes he can get in position to help in this situation and clears it off the line. Meanwhile, Johnny Evans, who is starting a Manchester derby in the year 2023.
For the first time since being sent off in a Manchester derby where they lost 6-1.
Yeah. The Mario Balotelli "Why Always Me" game is
this was
just
this
standing
was like a,
and watching
this was
all
just,
of this happen.
This was a funny. Well, that was a classic Johnny Evans move from his first United stint, was stand around and watch all the bad things happen in the box. This was pathetic for so many reasons. To start, the sequence starts with Rodri having the ball about 30-35 yards out from goal in the half space. United have 11 men behind the ball. Rasmus Højlund is like close to the ball. They're all back. And Rodri still plays a ball to a wide open Kyle Walker. Wide open. Who, on his first touch, plays it back now into the box, the cutback that, you know, is always open, to an absolutely wide open Phil Foden. United had 11 men back. How did two guys get wide open like this? I posted the picture on Twitter this morning because when he plays it back, they are in a perfectly symmetrical two diagonal lines of four. And then there's a diagonal line between Victor Lindelof and Rasmus Højlund. It's almost like a guard of honor for the City players parked in the box. How does that happen? That is why you can't disappoint me in these matches, because it's funny. It's well past being sad. What was sad was, I actually think United came out of this a little bit better. That's not true. There were people saying United, the first half wasn't that bad. And like, it was. It was awful.
United, it depends on what you mean by that bad. If it wasn't that bad, you know?
They had that chance right off the jump where this is the reason why you can't play Scott McTominay as the number 10 is the ball gets him off of a turnover. They are running at him. He's got Bruno and Hoyland to his right. He's got Rashford wide open to his left, and he takes a left-footed shot from the top of the box because he doesn't have the passing ability. He doesn't have that ability to play on the counterattack. And that was their last shot for a half hour. And then they got one more at the 30th minute mark, and then they got two more just before halftime. There was zero threat. Now, did you know City were a little mundane too, but City were in complete control of this match. And then in the second half, Ten Hag took off Amrabat, who was invisible until the 40th minute. He did something in the 40th minute, and I remember standing around at the bar being like, oh, Sofyan Amrabat, welcome to this match. Amrabat, and they lost their structure in the second half without Amrabat. That's one of those you don't know what you got till it's gone situations, because Amrabat had made 12 passes in the first half and only five of them were forward. This was not exactly someone helping the cause. And then things got a lot worse, but you have these bad games sometimes where everybody questions the effort and the application of the players, and you know that they don't care. And I'm always just like, it's not that. It's you're putting players that can't do certain jobs into a situation where it asks them to do jobs that they can't do, and because they can't do it, that puts other players in bad situations, and therefore teams are able to just pass the ball around them because nobody's in position and it looks like they're not trying. This wasn't so much that, so much as just like, this is City. They're really good. We spoke about it last week. They're really good. They're really boring. Their matches are dreadful to watch. And it just seemed like even if you did know what you were doing, like Ole-Gunnar Solskjaer in his first four Premier League derbies, that's not true. He lost the first one. But there was a period where Ole-Gunnar Solskjaer won three out of four Premier League derbies against City. And he did it mostly the same kind of way. And he seemed to know what to do to beat Pep Guardiola. And if he was the coach yesterday and you employed those tactics, wouldn't have mattered. City would have won 2-0, 3-0 or something, because even if you were compact and good and absorbing of the pressure and ready to hit them on the counterattack, City were ready to defend every counterattack. Like we said, Guardiola is looking for that perfect structure and perfect football match, and he's very close to having found it, and it's very boring. And that was it. That was really where the gulf was. It wasn't lack of effort and lack of all those different. It was just like they're so much better than United right now, on top of the fact that the coach has no idea what he's doing.
I mean, they won the treble pretty comfortably in the sense that like the final stretch of the season was basically, you know, nobody really doubted them at that point. Once Arsenal's collapse sort of started in like February, March, it was just kind of assumed that they were going to be able to walk the league.
I think Arsenal's collapse is a little overblown because City also like won like 15 straight. Yeah,
it's the same thing that happened.
And
when
they only won the league by 5 points. They beat Arsenal twice down the stretch. That's 6 points right there.
Yeah, it's the same thing they did when they beat Liverpool to the league. I guess
they do that thing
two
every
seasons
year.
Where, you know, 97 points wasn't enough and then like 94 points wasn't enough. But Arsenal also, like, Liverpool dropping points in that stretch was like a draw against Ollie's United in the weirdest injury game ever, and then another draw. And like, that's what lost the league, really. And people can go back to that City Liverpool game in February or whatever and point to that. But I mean, If you drop four points for 4 months and that's what loses the league, you're up against a super team that is financially doped, well run, and has one of the best managers of all time. That being said, when it comes to, like you said, the criticism of players and when it comes down to effort and things like that, that is always easy. When it comes to these sort of games, the rivalry games where United are just played off the park, what is really worrying?
What was sad early was that it also, like the first 25 minutes, sort of seemed like, you know the cliche and the trope of like, oh, you could always throw out the records when these two teams play against each other, which is meant to say even if a team is shit, they raise their game when they play their rivals, and you can never count them out. And it seemed like City did that in this game, in that they said, well, throughout the record book, doesn't matter that United shit, it's a derby. And they treated it like a cagey derby, rather than being like, well, United are shit, we can just do whatever we want and move through them. And that, I think, kept the game closer, simply because City were like, well, it's a derby match, like, let's not go too crazy here. And then in the second half, like, you saw that they just...
Well, like, that's kind of what worked when United have beaten City in the last, like, 5-6 years, especially under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, was they came into these kind of expecting, like, we're going to have we're going to have to break them down, and they're going to hit us on the counterattack. What's really worrying me is that this is kind of like the 2-0 loss to City in the, you know, the last days of Solskjaer, where City kind of had that approach, but they were just so far and away the better team, playing against a Manchester United that was totally lost in any sense of structure and direction. And when that United side had played Liverpool, what, 3 weeks earlier, Liverpool's heavy metal football, like, destroyed them in a way that has stuck with us. Like,
yeah,
that is one of the lowest points of Manchester United post Sir Alex Ferguson, probably in the history of Manchester United. Like, obviously getting relegated in the 70s was unheard of for that team at the time, as well as it would be now. But given the way that modern football is structured, and the way that United are still able to outspend everyone and go get good players, playing like this, like they played on Sunday, is way more worrying than anything to do with effort.
Yeah, I remember saying when Haaland scored that second goal, and people were like, "Oh, this is it. Like, the doors are going to be blown off us right now." And I was like, I don't think so. I think City got their big win last year. They got it last year. That's good enough for them. Now they're just like, all right, like, you guys are kind of pathetic. Like, we'll take it easy on you. We'll just do what we do. And I said, maybe Haaland gets a hat trick. Like, he's probably the one that's determined to score, because he's on a hat trick, and that'd be big. Score a hat trick in the derby. I went, they're not going to win 4-0. So, like, maybe they get 3, is probably going to end 2-0. And it was Phil Foden who got the third. But it was just like, yeah, they're not going to be like, we can make these guys bleed. I'm like, they're more than happy to, like, eat a regular standard dinner, get ready for the next day.
When Haaland lined up for that free kick in stoppage time, like, he definitely wanted his hat trick. That was the only time I think I've ever watched Haaland in his career so far and thought, oh, he can't do that. Like,
yeah,
he doesn't want to
take free kicks.
You're not a free kick guy. Trust
like
me,
the reality, like,
trust me, pal, you're not that guy.
City took 20 shots and had an XG per shot of 0.17, which is just absurd. Like, you don't get that on 20 shots. That's like, you can get that when you take 8 shots, because you had 2 counterattacks and 2 shots from point blank that really inflate your XG. Like, that's how thorough a domination this was. City really should have had a lot more. Andre Onana,
it was 4.55 like, XG, right?
Yeah, with the penalty. 3.3 without the penalty. And like, Andre Onana did the one thing you could say about the midweek game is maybe that penalty save really helped him, because he was on his game on Sunday. It's everybody in front of him. It's everybody in front of him, and it's the guy on the sidelines, because this was the same energy as you've already brought up the game. This was the same energy when I saw that starting 11 as when I saw the starting 11 against Liverpool when they lost 5-0 under Ollie. When they barely beat Atalanta, and they pretty much got played off the park, only for like Ronaldo to pull one out of his ass and get the 3 points, and Solskjaer ran back the same 11 against Liverpool 3 days later. And I'm like, well, you're trying to get fired here, because this just means you don't have a clue. And when I saw that 11, I was like, what are you trying to do here? And it's frustrating. You take Bruno Fernandes, who would be the guy to launch these counterattacks, and you stick him out on the right, and you put Scott McTominay in the middle. Like, we know, like, again, it's hopefully the ball falls to him for a shot. And it did. Right at halftime. And he took a very good shot. It was saved. It was a very nice save. But like, that's what I was saying to people around me. I was like, you're playing McTominay there for in hopes that one time that ball comes and he's got to finish it. And now that it came, you should probably take him off because there's not more chances there because Scott McTominay is there. You're ruining the amount that you can create. And it was evident on that second, third minute chance off the turnover where he couldn't run the counterattack and he had options and he couldn't do it. And he shoots over to his left. Like it was just bizarre. Like I remember watching the Arsenal match. I remember on this show talking about it after the Arsenal match, was it kind of just seemed like Ten Hag looked at what this team did under Solskjaer, what made them successful, and said, we should do that. But he doesn't know how to coach that. He doesn't know how to coach that. He doesn't know how to coach the counterattack. He doesn't know how to make them a cohesive unit and then be able to launch counters. He is still stuck on this man-to-man defense in midfield, which, like, if you want to play man-to-man defense, you got to put pressure on the ball because otherwise they're going to make – the other team's just going to be patient and they're going to make runs. And
you have to be able.
They're going to drag you out of position, and eventually somebody's going to be open, and that keeps happening. And then everybody
It's not just that. It's like if you're not going to be able to apply pressure, you have to be able to interrupt it in some way. Because we constantly see these situations where they're passing the midfield by in 3 seconds. It's like we saw this. I think. In the final stretch of the season last year as well. In the Newcastle game, we saw it in the FA Cup semifinal against Brighton, and we definitely saw it in the final against City, where this sort of areas where Manchester United's forward line and midfield are, applying their press, it's basically just like for visuals. It's not being applied in a way that is actually putting anyone under pressure, especially teams that are built to play through that. And they're doing it so, so comfortably.
Yeah. It's as soon as you get, when you play this man to man thing, as soon as you get by one guy, now either someone's got to leave their man and then it's simple, like 2-on-1 basketball stuff, or they don't leave their man and they just let you walk through the middle of the field. And you mentioned about that, like, how many progressive carries do United allow per game, basically? And the entering this season, the largest number that they allowed per game in the last since 2017-18 was 2017-18 under Mourinho, that year where they also overachieved and De Gea stood on his head. And yeah, they were letting teams just do whatever they wanted. The following year, it was about the same, a little lower. Under Solskjaer, it got down to 17.05 and 15.08 before creeping back up just a little bit. This year, it's 22.3 progressive carries a game we allow. So teams are just walking through our midfield. And yeah, I expect Manchester City to do it, but it's not just City. It's Sheffield United. It's Burnley. It's everybody. Like, that's what's so astonishing.
Yeah.
City did it 31 times. City did it 31 times. That is the joint highest. You know who it's joint with? It's not Arsenal.
The Liverpool?
Well, no, because we haven't played Liverpool yet. Joint highest.
I thought you meant like in the Premier League this season.
No, against us. It is joint highest with Wolves. And the next top number is 29. That was Brighton. That makes sense. The next highest number, 28, Tottenham, also makes sense. Also Burnley. Like, everybody's doing it. He doesn't seem to know how to prevent this and how to stop this. And it's like we've been saying for a while, like, he's not getting the best out of his players. You're moving some of your best players out of your best positions for what? What's the purpose of playing Bruno on the right wing to put McTominay as the 10? Like, if it was Mason Mount, I'd be like, all right, I kind of get that. I would switch them. Personally, I would put Mount on the right wing and Bruno at number 10. But like, for McTominay, like, what are you gaining out of that other than you're losing all of
your
best
attributes. Like in this game, you're not going to be putting McTominay in those sort of positions that, you know, is the point of putting him on the pitch. You know, looking for him to kind of act as a second striker, crash in the box and cause chaos and maybe find a goal. He's, I mean, we've talked about in the past that he's given space on the ball because teams have realized, like, what are you going to do? And that's, you know, if he even is going to be on the ball. When Amrabat was playing in the first half, you know, he was kind of the base of the pivot, but the structure
had, Amrabat couldn't get the ball
collapsed.
Either.
Yeah, the structure had already collapsed in United's midfield. Eriksen came on and it was basically the same thing. City scored a second goal right after halftime and they were away from there.
But City, that second goal from City, the way they got through the midfield, super easy. And it's,
yeah,
it's like one loose ball outside of the box.
And it was,
and
it was from when United
and
were
one
pushing
pass,
forward.
Now you're relying on Christian Eriksen and Scott McTominay to stop a transition. Like, that's never going to happen. Yeah. And this is like, you signed Christian Eriksen, a career attacking midfielder, and said, we're going to play you as a number eight. As we're going to play you in a pivot as a deep guy. And we've all known that Scott McTominay is not that guy. He can't play there. Every manager has figured that out. And yet we're still doing that. It's so mind-boggling to either not have any other ideas or not figure out of like, all right, how do we hide their weaknesses and try to make this work for everybody? And like, we haven't even spoken about the fact that Johnny Evans started this match. Sergio Reguilon and Rafael Varane were on the bench. And Ten Hag telling us that it was a tactical decision told us so much. Like, he basically acknowledged if Rafael Varane was on the pitch, City would have killed him.
But also, when it came time that he could make subs and he's like, okay, I'm putting Reguilon on, he chose to take off Lindelof and keep Johnny
right,
Evans
rather
on
than
for
Evans.
The full 90 rather than just having Victor Lindelof move central. This whole
right.
time, also
but,
playing Harry Maguire
like
is not preferred.
Maguire and Lindelof are not, Maguire and Lindelof under Ten Hag are not as good as Maguire and Lindelof were because he flips them around and he doesn't let Maguire play on the left side. So maybe Johnny Evans is better on the left side than Victor Lindelof is better on the left side, And that's not a, Johnny Evans isn't good, but that's not a high bar because Victor Lindelof ain't good on the left side. What I thought was telling was he basically acknowledged, I can't play Rafael Varane if the other team's going to press us. Is kind of what he said, because he said with a team that presses, he said City would attack Varane. Like, they'd let the ball get there and then they'd attack him. He'd be the pressing trigger. He's been the pressing trigger for everybody this year. And then he said Maguire's better at making those passes, especially when he plays from the right side, especially against the team that presses us. But what he basically said was Maguire's higher in the pecking order right now, because he said, if I would have put Varane in, then I would have had to move Maguire over. There was never like a question of like, you could put Varane and Lindelof with Reguilon, like, or Varane and Johnny Evans. It was, well, no, like, Maguire was obviously going to start. And therefore, if I put Varane in, then I had to move him to the left side, in which case I'd have those issues, whatever they are. I don't know. Cause every time we watch Maguire play on the left side, he's way better than he is on the right. And I would have this issue with Varane being a pressing trigger. Or he's just saving Varane for the Carabao Cup.
I'm curious when Lisandro Martinez comes back and is able to, you know, play and not play through injury. If Maguire still kind of holds that position in the pecking order and they try again, like they did in the first two matches last season, playing Maguire to the right of Licha. But
I mean, the issue is ahead
still
of them.
Probably 2 months
like,
away from that. And I don't know if Aaron Ten Hag's going to be here in 2 months.
Right. Go look on the Twitter. I put out, I actually didn't update it with the screen grabs from yesterday, but they're there. And it's just, look at the buildup structure. And it's like, where's anybody supposed to pass the ball? Because there's no options in midfield. And I do think if Martinez came back today, I do think Maguire would start next to him. And I think they'd run into the same problem. I'm not 100% sure that Maguire and Martinez is a good defensive pairing, but we haven't really seen them other than those two games together last year. I don't know if they played together after. I think they did a few times, but like, Maguire played with Lindelof a bunch. He played with Shaw.
It's weird that, like, there's evidence to suggest that Erik ten Hag is a manager who recognizes things like form. And then there's a lot of evidence, like Antony.
There's a lot more evidence that,
he does not.
Did Maguire play?
Which, I guess we can talk about it.
He played next to him against Everton. Okay. But so basically, like, we're going off those first two games, which is hard to judge by. Like, first of all, that Brighton match wasn't as bad as people made it out to be. And the Brentford match, again, that wasn't Maguire's fault. But, and that, I don't even think that was the defense's fault. That was just a calamity from everybody. And Maguire kind of got scapegoated, and Varane came in and started playing very well immediately, that it became much easier to not deal with that situation. I also think the narrative has led to United willingly picking worse defenders because it's just easier. But like, yeah, like you said, like sometimes it seems like he's ready to, he could notice form, and sometimes he's just not. And now United are in this massive, massive mess, and most of it is Ten Hag's creating.
Yeah, which I don't know if this will, you know, we can transition out of talking about the game specifically and talking more about Ten Hag and United's personnel. But we've mentioned already a few times this season how it seems like that part of management is something Erik ten Hag is just getting completely wrong over and over again this season, of, you know, personnel issues, you know, disciplinary issues within the club. I mean, this Jadon Sancho thing just keeps on dragging out. And, you know, we talk about the Antony and the Greenwood situations earlier this season. And
Sancho's sitting there like, I'm going to outlive ten Hag, which I said right at the beginning. Yeah. I said, well, you'll outlive him anyway. And now it's really looking likely.
Yeah. But when it comes to, I mean, it was always like last season, you kind of understood that, like, the tactics part of it, at least, was, it seemed like it was working out. Whereas now it just seems like he doesn't have any answers. And given the fixture list coming up, you have to wonder what the timeline is now, if we are on the crash course, if it is like fully underway now.
But like, see, here's the thing, you can't,
when does this thing totally go off the rails? Because the ownership situation is obviously another factor in it, but
it's the ownership situation's an excuse, and I'm not discounting it, but I'm not Gary Neville either. You know, Gary Neville wakes up, stubs his toe, and blames the Glazers. Before we started recording, I'm seeing that clip now circulating from the beginning of the season saying saying Jurgen Klopp would swap his midfield with United's right now. You know, that's how Gary Neville felt going into the season. Now, of course, it's the Glazers' fault, and everything's the Glazers' fault. And United fans, Jamie Carragher can come to your house and offer you £1 million, and United fans will be like, no, nothing that comes out of his mouth can be true. Right? Jamie Carragher is one of the better pundits out there. And I think he's probably the most objective one. He is not one, like, your pundits kind of fall into like three categories. And that is former United players that are just bitching, like, things were better in my day, and yeah, yeah, yeah. The Roy Keane hard man, and Neville is amongst that, of like, here's how we did it back then. You've got the other contingent of like, United ruined my career / childhood, so I'm always against them. And then there's like the third contingent of like, there's a good objective person. Let's call it Thierry Henry, Jamie Carragher. Both of them are in that. And then there's the fourth. We're here for the banter, which is Micah Richards. Which, very good role, important role to have. But Carragher's like been very objective, and he's been calling Neville out about it. Like, you're complaining, like, yes, it is the Glazers' fault that you have a bad structure in front of Erik ten Hag, but you also spent an entire season when Ralf Rangnick was here, and even before Rangnick came in, getting rid of all your scouts. And Ed Woodward had announced his resignation, and you said Richard Arnold's going to take over. John Murtaugh is going to become the football director. Darren Fletcher is going to become the technical director. They hired new scouts. They hired a data team. They put all these things in place, and you can't say you don't trust them because they weren't even given a chance to fail, let alone succeed. And right away on the first thing, Erik ten Hag was like, I want control over this. And they just gave it to him. And yes, someone should have stepped in and said, no, no, no. Like, the problem is John Murtaugh agreed to it. So the Glazers can't really come down on him and say they can't really fire John Murtaugh for agreeing to that. If that's how John Murtaugh, who's the football director, wants to run, wants to do his job, that's how he wants to do his job. It's a terrible way to do his job. No manager should be in charge of transfers. That is just, there's too much that needs to be done these days. You have too much time. That managers barely even spend time in the training pitch anymore because they're so busy. There's so much watching your next opponents, figuring out how you're going to play, all the tactical sessions, the commercial things, all these different things that you have to do. You do not have the time to sit around and find a player in Europe, let alone the rest of the world, and scout him. You just don't have that time. And if you're leaving the manager in charge of it, that's how you end up with a guy like Erik ten Hag who goes, oh, I played against this guy and that guy played for me. And you're casting a very narrow net there, whereas you have a whole team of people who it's their job to do this full time while you're out on the training ground, while you're out, while you're in meetings with the players, while you're at a commercial engagement. These guys are looking for players for you. They're going to find the better ones. Let them do that job. This is this isn't a knock on Ten Hag. This is any manager. Pep Guardiola has no say over these things. If Pep Guardiola had a say on who was around the city, Ilkay Gundogan would still be there. He very publicly spoke about how he wanted to re-sign him last year. And City were just like, no, you're gone. You think Pep wanted Calvin Phillips? Because Calvin Phillips has played like 7 minutes for City. Very obvious. Pep did not want him at all. And there have been other players like that. Ferran Torres never really got a shot at City. Pep, that was not a Pep signing. Like, he doesn't have the say over this. And no manager should. Erik ten Hag has zero experience scouting and recruiting and everything. He didn't do that at Ajax. But every manager wants that ability. They want to be the guys that sign the players and everything, even though they don't have the experience, they don't have the time to do it. You can't let them do that. So Jamie Carragher's right. Like, the Glazers have spent money, and Erik ten Hag has to look inward and be like, why do we have all these crappy players? Like, well, those are the ones you wanted. And Erik ten Hag is also the one when he got hired by United said, I want this control. And yes, it's a problem that John Murtaugh relented and gave him that. And you can't say, oh, I don't trust Murtaugh, because he never really got a shot to do the job. Now, I mean, he got a shot to do the job, and here's how he chose to do it. And for that, I don't trust him. And for that, he should be sacked.
But also, the job John Murtaugh was doing before this was, like, player...
signing the Garnachos.
Scouting player analysis, like, for United. Like, he worked as a youth manager, I think, for a little while from, like, under Louis van Gaal until Jose Mourinho, and then he was, you know, one of the kind of chief scouts, talent identifiers, whatever you want to call them. Like, he was an internal hire in the same way that Richard Arnold is basically another Ed Woodward. He was an internal hire. You know, his background is in marketing for telecommunications companies. He came and he built up MUTV. Like, these are all the same. This is the same thing. These are the Glazers people who the Glazers know will do the job that will make them money.
Yes. I'm in favor of, like, clearing house and getting new people. I'm not in favor of the narrative like Erik ten Hag said, I can't trust you guys, because they had never done it before. Like, you can't look at the job that United did in 2019 and 2020 and be like, because of this, I need control, because it's different people. And they should be sacked because they let him do it. And it shouldn't be any manager, let alone Ten Hag, but they gave him that control. They relented. And obviously he's gotten it completely wrong. And that's where you end up in this situation now, where he's kind of Mourinho'd it, in that if he left now, you still have this huge mess and he gets to go on about his life. Where and now the problem is, you agreed to let him borrow next summer's budget to go and spend, to go and sign Antony and Casemiro. So where do you think this past summer's budget came from? It came from somewhere that wasn't just this summer. So you're eventually that's going to run out. So like you hire a new guy. I do think that someone else could get more out of this team right now. But how much more? They'd be competing for the top four. That's the ceiling of this club. I don't think that the squad is as good this year as they were last year, because I don't think Casemiro is as good and Christian Eriksen isn't as good and Marcus Rashford isn't going to be as good. He was never going to replicate a career high in goals. It just wasn't going to happen.
Especially not playing like this.
Right.
Where, you know, you're not getting him the ball in those same situations.
Right. I think a lot of the players just aren't as good. Like the natural progression of the team isn't to get better right now. It's getting worse because the age is so high. That you're in the second year of a long-term plan. And you spoke about a long-term plan when you first got here. If you're going to be in year two, if you have a long-term plan, you need to be closer to competing for a title than you were in year one. Even if you are still very far away, if you were 100 miles away in year one, even if you're only 98 miles away now, you need to be closer. But this team's further away. And next year, they'll be even further away. And at a certain point, it's probably next year, maybe the year after, there isn't really going to be money to blow up this team and really add new reinforcements. And they need a lot of, like, the window of most of these players is over. They need a lot of players to clear out, not just the ones that are not just the Martials and the Lindelofs and those bench guys. There's a lot of guys that are in the squad that need to be moved on from, that need to become either squad players or go somewhere else. And we're hoping for a bailout from Saudi Arabia. I don't know if Saudi Arabia is going to have the same strategy as a league next summer that they did this summer. They may have said we made our splash. We may not be spending big money on players anymore. There's 700 people showing up to games.
Yeah, they're not raking in TV or match day revenue. So it becomes a question of like, at what point do they commit to the grift? Kind of like the Chinese Super League when they realized it wasn't gonna like
China started off. Taxing them. China yeah. started like taxing them like 100% for transfer fees. So like an 80 million pound fee was like 160 million pounds they had to pay.
Right.
Saudi Arabia, it's only four clubs that are controlled by the Saudi wealth fund. And there's still rules in place as to how many foreigners can be on the pitch at one time. So like, that was already like an issue with Mitrovic, I think, was someone couldn't get a move because they had already maxed out their slots. So unless these guys start moving, there's only four clubs you can go to. And it's very possible that they'll be like, we made our splash. And now we're not doing it next summer, or maybe they do it. But like, that's what we're hoping on is a bailout. So any new manager that comes in, like, sure, maybe they can. I think the top four is kind of gone this season already, but that's the ceiling you're dealing with. And then eventually, like, you're going to be like, this team needs the next manager is no position to succeed at all. Whereas I would say Erik ten Hag walked in a position where he could succeed if he did the right thing. And that is be like, I'm building my team not around Cristiano Ronaldo. I'm just going to use the players that are here that have proven to be good and use them to their strengths. And he did that last year, but he did that with short-term purchases. And those things are coming. The rooster coming home to roost or whatever. The
chickens are coming home to roost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's basically, I think, look, this isn't the way to go about it, but I think you just have to look at Erik ten Hag and be like, you could resign, in which case we don't owe you money because they also can't afford to pay two coaches at once again. You resign. Otherwise, this is the team you built. You built this team. Go ahead and coach it. It's on you. And maybe that hurts his reputation that he undeservedly had. But I, you know, if Erik ten Hag walked away tomorrow, I don't think he's getting a job. And you know, outside, where's he getting a job?
He's going back to Ajax. I mean, they're in 18. Yeah,
basically. And I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. Erik ten Hag would go to Ajax, and he wouldn't he wouldn't really, he'd have some effect there, but not too much of an effect. They've lost, Ajax lost 10 of the 11 guys that were in their starting 11 for their title winning team 2 years ago. And they lost their coach, and they also lost the guy that built the whole thing. That's pretty much where they're like, they are still bad because they don't have that guy anymore, and they're not replacing all those players who are good and went all across to Europe and are all playing the Champions League. They have not replaced them with the same quality of players.
Yeah. I was gonna say, oh right. I tweeted, I think midweek, I think it was during the Champions League game, of like trying to think positively. If this is the crash course, it seems like it's going to come to a head around the time Jim Ratcliffe is starting to get his people in charge. So if we're going to say give Erik ten Hag the rest of the season, by then, ideally,
I give him the rest of the season and next season.
And next season, just make him be like, do it.
This summer you can only spend what you bring in.
Yeah, or you can
sign up. And you're not in charge of it. You're not in charge of it because you need to, they need to, like, the one, not the one, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer walked into a good situation for a bunch of reasons, some of which played against him. One of which was, like, everybody looked at that team and said, it's not a tactical issue here. It's a vibe issue. Like, we just need vibes. This is a good squad. But he also had a potential game changer in Rashford was like 21. He had a potential game changer in Martial, who had been very good the year before.
And he had a guy who could piece things together in Paul Pogba.
Luke Shaw was like 23. Way. It was like, hey, just stop playing like Alexis Sanchez and the old guys. And you've got something here. Like, we don't know if Garnacho is as good as Rashford. We have really high hopes for Kobbie Mainoo, but we don't know what he is. Kobbie Mainoo, like, that was kind of McTominay back then. McTominay had more experience, but when Solskjaer took over, it was like, one of the questions for the following season was, can Scott McTominay be your holding midfielder? And we answered that. It was no. But he had a young team to build in, and that doesn't really exist here. But also what he crucially had was that they didn't go crazy with their spending the year before. And so... Yeah. They literally couldn't. And that's what's going to happen.
Because Jose Mourinho spent
They needed to reset their books, and they did. So his year one, they were able to do things. And that's what's going to happen next summer. So if you bring in a new manager now, year one, he's going to be like, I've got an old Casemiro, an old Christian Eriksen, and I've got no money to replace them.
Yeah. We're not going to have the flexibility to do the, I need to get younger at these positions, so we'll bring in Harry Maguire to replace Phil Jones, Chris Smalling. We'll bring in Aaron Wan-Bissaka to replace Ashley Young.
Maguire was actually on the old side. From an age standpoint, bad signing.
Yeah, he was. It was like, what, 26?
He's 26. Yeah. Like, he was, and an old 20, like 26 for a defender is young, because typically defenders don't break through until they're like 21, 22, as opposed to attackers who will get
in. They can also generally like play longer.
But they play longer because they start later, is one of those things. Harry Maguire was in there at 18. So he's the same 26 as like an attacking player is at 26. From an age profile perspective. So like, that's the other thing, is he's in his 30s now. You got to move. You've got a bunch of defenders that are in their 30s. There's a lot of players that need to be moved on. And we've spoken about this before. Like, Aaron Wan-Bissaka is going to sign a new contract this year. So you've got two right backs who are young, but we've also spoken about, like, that's like a weak position for United. Neither one of them are good enough. And now they become the guys that are like, well, we don't need to address right back because those are the guys that are actually young enough to play here.
Oh, they're not like young though, are they? They're like 24, 25, both.
Yeah, but everybody, what are the ages of your center backs? Martinez is like 26, and he's the youngest by a mile. And Luke Shaw's like 27. He's on that contract. He's got a few years, but like by the end of that contract, you kind of need Luke Shaw to be the backup in that area, in a position where your backup actually plays pretty frequently. And like midfield, it's you're putting a lot of pressure on, you're putting a lot of hope on Kaui Manu.
Yeah.
And is Dan Gore going to be like anything?
If Antony actually becomes droppable, Ahmad as well.
A lot of pressure on him. He's hardly played in the Premier League before. Right. You know, he's not exactly someone that I could at least be like, well, we know what Ten Hag sees in Garnacho. And you could ask questions like, why isn't he playing? I would say, I said this last week, he's earned a start. I wouldn't have started him against City. I would start him against Fulham regardless. Now it's definitely you got to come on, dude. Yeah. But Garnacho has not exactly been a creative left winger either. He's not creating shots or anything. He's shooting himself.
He doesn't offer anything other than Rashford.
Direct, and I'm going to shoot you.
Yeah, he's kind of like the young Rashford.
Right, but young Rashford was a striker who scored goals.
Right.
And then they moved him to the left wing, and then they moved him back to striker. And then they
experience.
And that's one of the good things they're saying about Ten Hag is there's not moving Garnacho around. He's basically you're a left winger, and you're going to learn how to play left wing. And there's a value to that, but it might mean that you don't get on the pitch as much. But is he as good as Rashford? That if someone else were to come and take over the team now, tomorrow, do you have that potential player that you can build around? You have Rasmus Højlund. That's where the hope is. And that's kind of the younger Antony is 23. He's in that age, but no. Yeah, where else is everything going to be? I'll say this. I think the one thing Ten Hag's doing really well is managing Højlund's minutes. Is they were honest right at the beginning of the season and saying he's got this injury. We have to watch him. He can't play twice a week. He can't play 90 minutes twice a week for sure. And he's not letting the situation dictate. He's not letting it be like, oh, we need a goal. I'm just going to leave Højlund out there. It's all right. Yeah. He can only play 60 minutes today. We need a goal, but I'm taking him off. I got to rest him. I think that's good. The problem is he's, the rest of your team is in win now mode. And the only striker that provides a threat is in develop for the next year or two mode.
Yeah.
You got Newcastle in the energy cup drink.
Yeah.
Do we think the home streak?
We'll see how that goes.
That's a tough one. It's the first time I've had to play a top half team in the under Ten Hag outside of the semifinals.
Yeah, I mean, this schedule over the next few games is, I would say, manageable, even with Newcastle. I mean, losing that one, if you can get wins against Fulham, Luton, and Everton, although I think, Fulham is maybe trickier than advertised, and Everton has been kind of weirdly successful in recent games. Not to the point that Everton used to be, where they were, 6 to 8 range, but they've been able to. They're not managed by Frank Lampard anymore.
They've won 3 of 5. They've won 3 of 5. But what's been strange? Yeah. Do you remember when they played United last year at Old Trafford under Sean Dyche, and it was wait, Everton are playing very high up the pitch, and it was why? Why are they doing? Yeah. And they let Rashford and Antony have all that space to run behind them, and Antony missed about 700 chances, and United only won 2-0 or something when they should have won 9-0.
Yeah.
And it was weird. Why are they doing that? But now they're doing that a lot. They did that against Liverpool, and they did it to West Ham. They're playing much more on the front foot and not the way you would expect Sean Dyche to play.
Yeah, they're a decent team.
And that can really, they're not a decent team. They're still crap. But that's the kind of thing that can give United problems.
They have a decent manager now. They don't have Frank Lampard.
They have a Premier League manager.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that can give United problems. But that's a long way away. That's an international breakaway.
Yeah, that's end of the month.
I'm pretty sure it's after Thanksgiving. There's no Europa League on Thanksgiving this year.
Yeah, it was the weekend after Thanksgiving.
It's a weird... Yeah, Thanksgiving's during an international break. It's a very weird schedule for those.
I mean, last year American was during the World Cup, so
we're all right, but that was fun. That was cool. But if you're an American, the deal of having to figure out a way to flip the TV over to the Europa League rather than the NFL on Thanksgiving.
Right.
And be like, guys, I swear this isn't, I mean, it is, it's going to be as bad as it looks, but.
I mean, I had to, 1 year on Thanksgiving, I had to watch like a group stage Europa League loss on the road to like Zorya Luhansk.
Astana was
Jesse,
it was
Lingard
in the morning.
It was before
the NFL started.
Right. It was a really weird vibe.
Right. Because they had already like, they basically were like, this game doesn't matter. If we beat Alkmaar, we win the group. And we're already going through. So Solskjaer just took all the youngsters. He was like, yeah, everybody else, I'm not traveling with my first team to Kazakhstan. He didn't even go. He like let the youth coach him. Yeah. It was literally like, we're sending a team out. We're just some 11 guys in Manchester United shirts will be on the pitch for.
Yeah. All right. Did we have more to talk about? We need to talk about Sir Bobby Charlton, at least a little bit. You also said you had thoughts on the Garnacho Andrea Nana thing from last week.
What do you think about that?
So I kind of agreed with what Devil's DNA tweeted about it, where this is very clearly a situation where Garnacho had no ill intent, and Andrea Onana understood that. And I think, you know, internally, the resolution was pretty straightforward and easy. When it comes to the suspension or potential suspension, I think it gets more complicated because just from like a moral standpoint, I think Devil's DNA tweeted, and I agree with this, that it propagates a racial stereotype that people sometimes unknowingly ascribe to, which I think in this situation, it was not intended in that way. But we need to point out that this is, you know, something that propagates a racial stereotype or a racist imagery that needs to be dealt with. When it comes to a suspension, I think that's maybe what they're going to lean on the FA if it comes to that.
I don't think it's difficult. I don't think it's complicated at all. I think if they're going to suspend him, you have to suspend him.
Yeah.
I think you should.
Was it three games for Cavani? But
it's along those same lines. Like, you have this relationship with Onana, and the beautiful thing about multicultural dressing rooms and everything is everybody's boys with each other, and they say all these things, and look, like, there are groups where they use stereotypes to talk to each other, and they do not mean them at all, but someone that is not one of them cannot say that. And you have people that aren't one of them that are boys with them. And they're like, you can say it to me because we're boys. And they'll call you by a stereotype that doesn't even fit what race or religion or anything you are. And you're just one of them. And Onana knew exactly what Garnacho was talking about. And he says, oh, yeah, like, we do this all the time in the group chat. And it's like, yeah, that's the group chat. You could say whatever you want in the group chat. That's between you and the other person. And your teammates see it and you all laugh and whatever, you can't say it publicly. And the issue that it creates is the Premier League or the FA can't look at it and be like, oh, you guys are boys? Okay, misunderstanding, we're going to let that go, because what if a week later someone does the same thing to Onana and does it as a racist thing? And then they go, then they point and they go, no, I didn't mean it as a racist thing. Like, you know, Garnacho did it last. Like, that's the door you open. So you have to be like, again, say whatever you want in the group chat.
Well, it's kind of in the same way that the Cavani thing was looked at in regards to the Suarez incident, because it was this, in that instance, it was a racial slur. It wasn't the emoji that it was in this case. And I think that, you know, automatically makes it different because it was a racial slur. But it's the same word that Suarez used in aggression towards Patrice Evra, and using it in a brotherly way on Instagram is not any better.
Right. You can't do it publicly. You can, the DMs, the group chat, you can do whatever you want, but publicly you have to treat it like that is, and it's for that reason. It's so that if someone comes out and does it the following week and means it, and does it with the intention of racially abusing someone that they can't then point to, well, wait, no, like that week, like a week ago, this person did it and you said it was fine.
Yeah.
It's just the line you have to take.
And for a football organization that has often avoided responsibility in situations where they're supposed to be the deferred authority, I really don't think the FA can afford to allow a situation or precedent like that to happen. So, yeah, I think we agree on that, that the suspension should probably come in. All right. Last bit on Sir Bobby Charlton before we get out of here. Obviously, a week ago, announced on the Saturday that United played Sheffield United, right? That,
yes,
that Sir Bobby Charlton had passed away at the age of 86. A couple of years ago, I think it was announced that he was beginning to suffer symptoms of dementia, which is a problem that a lot of footballers from the 60s and 70s have faced. But just in terms of, I mean, Sir Bobby Charlton's stature, I think Sue Wade kind of nailed it in his piece that he is kind of the one person you can maybe point to as Mr. Manchester United, just in terms of what he embodied and the life that he lived and the role that he played. As my cat is walking right in front of me. Yeah, just in terms of what he embodied as a figure with Manchester United, being a survivor with the Busby Babes and the Munich air disaster, being really the centerpiece of Busby's team for the next 10 years and eventually lifting the European Cup as captain. Being the record goal scorer for so long, a record that wasn't broken until Wayne Rooney in 2017. And somebody who, you know, winning the World Cup with England, being England's top scorer forever as well, was just kind of like the figure of English football for such a long time. I think, yeah, really just embodying that. We have another guest on this podcast now, ladies and gentlemen, Marcus Questel.
Yeah, he's here. A little fussy. Yeah, I thought Sue Wade got it right. Like, you'd call him a saint. He really, like, there is no one has ever, I don't think anybody ever has anything bad to say about it. Unfortunately, in this sport, there are so many players where they're amazing and their abilities are just nothing short of like almost a deity. But then they step off the pitch and it's like there's a lot of buts there. But off the pitch, and Bobby Charlton had none of that. Just a model for everybody to look after, and just what he went on, like what he went through and then went on to accomplish is nothing short of just tremendous. Yeah, like you said, like Manchester United leading goal scorer, England leading goal scorer, England World Cup winner, Champions League winner, European Cup. Like the way that he just did all, like the one flaw that he had was that he had such a beautiful head of hair and it was gone by the time he was like 19.
Which I think is fitting that Wayne Rooney was the one who broke his records then, because
Wayne Rooney never had a beautiful head of hair. He just was also bald.
But yeah, by like the age of 25, 26.
The club posted that picture of Sir Bobby Charlton. And from like when he first broke into the team, which when he was like, what, 17 or 18, I'm like, that dude had some flow that was gorgeous. And you know, like the next pictures that like resonate of him are like in the 60s and he's just an old man.
He really leaned into it though. Like he just never like went.
He did. He didn't fight it, but I don't think he had the technology the to fight it.
Yeah.
I don't think we had the technology to fight it in the 60s.
Yeah. But also like, you know, none of us watched him play. Like My dad saw him play. My dad was a child when Sir Bobby Charles.
I have watched the game. I have watched the one game of that the Busby Babes that exists on the internet.
Yeah,
and it's brutal. Like he played in an era. He played an era where like it was all one on one battles, and he was fantastic. So like if you got him the ball, he did magical things with it. But like they couldn't get him the ball because passing didn't exist back then. And part of that was the pitch quality and the ball quality and everything. But like it was a one on one sport back then.
Yeah, I mean it was like kicking a lead ball, but he could still smack that thing. Like,
yes,
some of his highlights are ridiculously impressive.
Yes, it was a different game though.
Yes, And part of why he stood out was he actually had like technical ability. Like,
yeah,
during COVID, I watched the 1963 FA Cup final, which was, I think Gordon Banks was in goal for Leicester City. So there was another England great there. But that was before like Dennis Law, George Best, Paddy Craren. Before that, United team was actually like really good. Like this was them kind of getting back on the right track after, you know, 5 years on from their team being decimated by tragedy. And Bobby Charlton was the only person who could do anything with the ball. Like he was played out on the left wing in that game. I think he wore number 11 and he was just head and shoulders above everyone else on the pitch.
Yeah. That's what stood out to me in the, when I watched that 1957 FA Cup final was like Duncan Edwards, the only guy that got the ball and like tried to pass it. And I'm like Duncan Edwards, I know like all the accolades about Duncan Edwards, and I'm always like rolling my eyes being like, all right, come on guys. Like, because the reality was like, he very well might've just been Phil Jones, but then I'm like, he also might be the only guy you could plug in from that era right now. And he'd be like, oh wait, like you're Rodri. Like, this is exactly what we need you to do.
It's like those insurance commercials where Chris Paul is like in the 1920s and he's the only one who's like, pass the ball.
Who can dribble?
Yeah.
not just standing there bouncing the ball, but could actually dribble.
Right.
Yeah. Like, I also find it funny, like, you know, like that they used to stick guys like Charlton on the wing like that. And the reason was like, oh, that's because that's where the grass is nicer.
Yeah.
It's like, that's where you could dribble.
Yeah. But yeah. At that time, I think there were the very obvious like stars of the game. Like Pele had come through, Eusebio for Portugal. George Best was kind of like the magical like dribbly boy. But the way that they stick out, and like George Best's peak was very fleeting. It was like 3 or 4 years. But Bobby Charlton belongs in that tier with...
He's right up there. And the difference all three of those players, you step off the pitch and you're like, okay, but
yeah.
And there's none of that with Sir Bobby.
Yeah. And his peak lasted 10 years. He was at the top of his game up through that European Cup run. Like, and I mean, he was starting with the Busby Babes. You know, he was a regular in that team at the age of 18, 19. So yeah. The whole Manchester United community kind of mourning over the past week. And part of what made the Derby loss that much more disappointing was everything leading up to the kickoff was, you know, this really beautiful tribute to Charlton. And then the game starts and it's like back to reality. We stink.
Right.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think that's going to do it for us this week. We'll be back next Monday. Hopefully we can have Nathan join us again. And yeah, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.